This is Interviews with Technical People with John Robertson
and James Haveu,
a podcast where we interview technical people in STEM fields
to discuss the past, present, and future from their perspective.
We have sort of an announcement. The announcement is just that this is our 10th episode. So thank you so much for everyone who's been along for the ride so far. And we have a very special person with us, James.
Today we are joined by Dr. Carmen Lau. Our first doctor on the show. So that's pretty exciting. Carmen is a veterinary pathologist, a veterinarian who specializes in autopsies, and recently finished a pathology residency at Texas A&M University after receiving her DVM at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln and Iowa State University. Carmen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I'm super excited.
Carmen, you bring something that was much needed to the show. I don't know if you've tracked the trajectory that we've had so far, but when we first were starting, it looked like we might be really like aerospace heavy. You know, a lot of our first guests were into those sorts of sciences and engineering. And we realized like, man, we need a little balance here. We need some other parts of the scientific spectrum. And that's part of the reason we are really thrilled to have you on to talk about a brand new topic for us. We have not approached this on the show so far. So, well,
lucky for you, I do very little physics, so.
That's what we know about, so.
I think we've had like 9 episodes of physics so far. So, Carmen, why don't you tell us what you do in your own words?
So, I'm a veterinary pathologist, which means first and foremost, I am a veterinarian, but then I specialized after I was done. And so, pathology is broadly known as the study of disease. And so, what I do basically is I do autopsies for animals, which we call necropsies. So after they die, they get sent to us and we open them up and we look at them, what we call grossly. So we just look at the body itself and we look at all the organs and we see, can we see why this animal died? Is there some sort of reason that we can see? And then if there isn't anything that we can see, or sometimes if we have more questions, we'll take tissues and we'll trim them in and we'll look at them under a microscope. And then we'll see if there's any disease process that we can identify in each of the organs that we're looking at, and basically identify cause of death.
So wow. You do animal autopsies.
I do.
So the first thing I want to ask, is this like dogs and cats or farm animals, wild animals? Is there, what do you specialize in?
So actually, we have to know all of the species. That's the special thing about pathology, is that you don't. So if you're just a regular vet, you can choose, I'm only going to do small animal, or I'm only going to do large animal, or I'm only going to do zoo animals. But if you're in pathology, you have to know everything. So I do mostly here in Texas, we do a lot of dogs. We do quite a few sheep, actually, and a lot of horses. We do get cows and cats and everything. And we get some crazy things, like the other day they had a zebra that I went in and looked at. That was pretty cool. So yeah, it's pretty neat.
And where are you based out of now?
So I'm in College Station. I'm at Texas A&M University. I'm down in Texas. Yes.
Wow. And zebras run wild down in College Station?
So Texas is a weird state and they have weird animal laws where you can own certain types of exotic animals. So quite a few people have like wallabies and kangaroos down here. Yeah,
I heard somewhere that like Texas has a very large number of, for example, people who have pet tigers.
Yeah, it's not false.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's very strange. There's an ostrich farm like right down the street. So, you know.
So can you walk us through? I mean, animals die all the time. Under what circumstances would somebody call you to need to do this task?
That's a great question that I ask my students all the time, because I do teach vet students as well since I work at a university. So there's basically 3 main reasons. So one is herd health. So say you have 100 cows and 3 of them die in one day. Well, you want to figure out what happened to them, right? So that the rest of your cows are safe. So whether that be an actual, like a virus, or if there's a toxin, or if they were struck by lightning, you know, any sort of reason. The second one is for small animals, for closure for people. Like, we've been treating my dog for cancer for a year, and I finally decided to put him down, and I just want to know that I made the right choice, because there's cancer everywhere. And it just gives a sense of finality for people that they may have not had before making that hard decision. And then the last one is usually legal reasons. So in this, we commonly think of racing horses. So racing horses can be up to, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and they're insured. And so sometimes when things happen on the track, if they break their legs, then we need to make sure, hey, they did actually break their legs and there wasn't some other mitigating circumstance that they died from, you know?
Yeah. Is of those three, is would you say that there's one that's most common where you are?
I would say legal is very uncommon. Mm-hmm. But the other okay. two is about, they go head and head, just depending on whether it's a food animal or a pet. And we get about 50-50, I would say, of each of those things.
Is there something that you kind of specialize in, whether it's, I don't know, soft tissue or more of, you know, skeletal stuff? Or is there something you enjoy more or spend more time with?
It's true. People usually do pick a specialty. Mine is actually reptiles. I really love reptiles. We just don't get them that commonly, so I don't get to enjoy that. But I love a good snake necropsy. They're real crazy. Their lungs are so long.
No.
So one thing real quick, Carmen, you're reminding me of that Seinfeld episode where Kramer gets sick and he doesn't want to go to a doctor. He wants to go to a vet. And his rationale is, human doctors only have to learn one animal, humans, but vets, they have to learn everything, a pig, a chicken, a horse, a frog, everything. And that was that to him. And it was a joke, but to him, that was an indication that vets were superior practitioners for that reason.
And in some ways, you can think of the pathologist as the veterinarian's veterinarian. So vets see a mostly common spectrum of things, right? So you see like upset tummies, you see pneumonia, you see broken legs, you see just the common things in a practice. And then the vet, the pathologist, we get the animals when they didn't know what was going on. So we get all the weird cases and the weird diseases, but we have to keep all the common differentials in our heads as well. So basically we have to know above and beyond what a vet would know.
So question on that, you mentioned that you were a veterinary pathologist, but that you also do these autopsies. But when I think of pathology often for human medicine, it's, you know, I think of the people down in the dark room looking at like microscope slides trying to diagnose diseases. But yours sounds very different. Is there that pathology aspect in veterinary medicine or how does that work?
Yeah. So I guess I'll just, if I could just go into the question of like describing my day, because that would be easier.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. So basically we start necropsies in the afternoons because we have students. We're teaching fourth year vet students who are going to graduate in May, and we teach them how to do a necropsy. And so we start by discussing the cases and we say, okay, this is the history that we have. This was their blood work. Let's list differentials. Sometimes the clinicians have differentials, sometimes they don't. And sometimes the differentials are wrong, so you have to keep an open mind. So we discuss them, and then we try and go into the necropsy with an open mind. We open up the animal, we take lots of pictures along the way, and we look at all the organs, and then we put them all in formalin. We take samples and we put them in formalin. And then the next day, then the resident will go back and trim in specific tissues, like, the liver looked weird on this dog, so let's trim in a piece of liver and a piece of lung and a piece of heart. And then we'll send that off for processing, and our histology lab will send those back as microscope slides. And then we have 2 weeks from when the case was submitted to read those slides and get them the results from the slides and from the necropsy back. And so basically it's like 50% is the necropsy or the autopsy, and then 50% is reading the slides and seeing what happened microscopically as well.
And does that, you know, the sending off of the slides to identify things, does that typically only happen for, you know, dead animals like a necropsy, or do they also, is that also not done for like live animals that just have a surgery?
It sure is. So we also do biopsies, which is the live animal surgery. So most frequently we do get tumors, especially skin masses, because everybody sees, oh, there's a mass on my dog's skin, let's take it off, you know, and most of the time it's fine. But
that happened with my dog 2 years ago.
Yeah, so it's very common. We get skin masses, we get internal masses, sometimes we get jaws or legs, or sometimes you get pieces of intestine, and we have to read those out as well. So for biopsies, we have two different services. You're either on necropsy or on biopsy. And for biopsy, the turnaround time is 24 hours. So we get it the one day, it fixes in formalin, we send it for processing that night, and then the next morning they'll trim it in for us and we'll read it out that day.
One thing that I found completely interesting, Carmen, is you're one of these really great cases where, so we knew you, goodness, we probably met about 9 years ago or so, maybe 10,
Yeah, 9 or 10.
You know, We met you and there was no doubt you were like, I'm going to become a vet. I'm going to go to vet school and this is what I'm going to do. And it's really fun to just, we have a long list of people like that, but who say they're going to do something, then they go and do it. At what point did you realize that veterinary pathology was the path for you as opposed to anything else? Did you always know that or was that a new development?
No, absolutely not. I had no idea. So you take your first pathology course in second year of vet school, and everybody was like, oh, Carmen, you should do this. Like, you seem really into it. You're really good at it. I was like, no way. Like, more school after this? No way. I'm not going to do that. And, you know, you always eat your words later. But I didn't decide until my fourth year what I wanted to do, right before the applications for residencies were almost due. And my classmates used to make fun of me. They're like, oh, Carmen, you know, she just wants to do everything. Like every time we have a speaker, she's like, oh, I want to do that. Or I want to go be like a cow embryologist, or I want to go be a swine vet, or, you know, and they used to make fun of me. But I think it was better for me for vet school because then it kept an open mind and I saw all these different sides that I was really interested in. So I thought it was really
So you didn't come in with your mind made up and what specialty you were going to do?
No, I thought I wanted to do zoo animals and that went out the window pretty quick.
It fascinates me. I was wondering about this because to me, one of the best things about being a vet sounds like it would be playing with the animals and just being around them. But you don't have that, right? But you found your thing, right? This is it. I mean, how does that go? Was that ever a motivation for you or no? You know, because another thing I'll say, and maybe you can comment on this, like vet school is a long and difficult road, right? And it takes a certain level of determination. So yeah, maybe just clue us into a little more like all the different routes you could have taken and sort of why this one really made sense for you.
Yeah, of course. So I did originally want to be a zoo animal vet, and then they also have to do a residency when they're done, and it's highly competitive. And I was like, you know what? I'm just not that level of crazy. So that was very quickly shot down, like I think within the first year of vet school. And then I was like, okay, so now I have all these options. So everybody starts with, I'm going to be a small animal vet because I was very comfortable with dogs and cats. But then we started.
Everybody loves dogs and cats.
Yeah, and puppies and kitties. Like, come on, this is what we live for, right? But then we had a class with cows in it. I had never worked with cows before. And then I got to help with a calving during calving season and pulling calves like at 3 a.m. in the morning. And it was so magical to see birth. And I was like, oh, calves, I'm definitely going to do cows. Like, this is it. This is where I stop. Like, I'm going to do cows.
Hey, Carmen, did you know I used to work on a dairy farm?
What? No.
Yeah.
John was a manure relocation technician.
That was on some of my resumes, manure relocation. But I was there several days where I think we called them like the large animal vet, where they would come and, you know, had this whole suite of things that they would help us out with. Everything from giving birth to giving like medicines and various things. But anyway, yeah. So I've seen them in action, which is kind of cool.
That's really cool.
I also worked on the farm, but I just picked vegetables.
But you've seen the animals. It's okay.
Yeah, they didn't have much for animals. They had a couple llamas and a couple goats.
Oh, llamas. Llamas are bad tempered. Yeah.
So, but anyway, so you're going through and seeing all these things.
Yeah. And I think the first tipping point was in second year. So I went to basically two different vet schools. So there was a cooperative program where I started at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln for 2 years with about 26 other students. And then in our final 2 years, we would relocate to Iowa State University with 125 other people. And we would finish because they had all the facilities and they had an actual hospital and we didn't. But that meant that when I was at the smaller program and we did have a diagnostic lab attached to our school, a pathology lab, that meant they would just let us come in and see whatever we wanted and help out whenever we wanted. And it was really cool. I remember that there was a mountain lion that had been shot in town because it was, you know, being too much in like human society and they couldn't relocate it. So they just shot it instead, which is understandable. And they let me come in and help on that. And I was just floored. I was like, this is so cool. Like just opening it up and like trying to track the bullets and find where the bullets were and find how many there were. And like, yeah,
I was going to ask what the pathologist needed to do. Like, isn't the cause of death pretty clear in that case?
So the cause of death is bullets, but where did the bullets go? Did they get it in the head? Did they get it in the liver and it bled out? Did they get it in the spinal cord? You know, and so we were trying to find out where they had hit it and what the ultimate cause of death was.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
And was that a legal issue?
More like a moral issue. Like how many times do you have to shoot a mountain lion before you actually kill it? Like, should you send a better sharpshooter out next time? Which they probably should. Yeah. But that's okay.
Yeah. That's a really interesting intersection of like science and ethics though. That's a cool example.
Yeah. Yeah. We get.
I also personally have this thing where it's not a phobia. I'm not afraid of mountain lions. I'm just very aware that mountain lions can attack people. So anyway, you mentioned mountain lions. I was like, huh, what happened?
I just don't see them. So I just assume when I'm in the woods that they're not there.
Oh, yeah. That seems like a safe assumption.
I just, you know, growing up in New York, I was assumed we don't have like large, fearsome beasts in North America. And then I came to California, found out I was wrong. No, we have like enormous, terrifying predators who like stalk people and can attack them. I know that's it's a complete exaggeration, but it has happened. Yeah, it has happened. You know, you're more likely to get like struck by lightning and all that stuff, but still,
That's
not as scary as a cougar attack. Yeah. Cool. Okay. So where were we?
Oh, yeah. So the mountain lion. And then basically as I present, like I went through vet school and all the time they would say like, hey, you're learning all this information, but you're probably only going to use about 25% of it in your daily life, because just because you specialize, like, because when you're in vet school, you learn everything, large animal, small animal, and a little bit of exotics. But then everybody goes into like only doing cows or only doing dogs and cats. And I kept hearing that. And I was like, well, that's bogus. I spent all this time learning all of this. And like, you're telling me I'm going to forget 75% of this. Like, I want a job where I'm going to remember all of this. And now I have a job that requires me to remember all of this. And I'm like, why did I pick this job? But it is fun. I really do like it. But yeah, we do have to know a lot of information all the time. But I love it. Like the more.
And you have to know all the animals.
Yeah, exactly. All the animals and all the organ systems and all the diseases. And yeah, it's frustrating and fascinating at the same time. I really love it.
How much do the organs change from one animal to the other?
Ooh, that's a good question.
The intestines are probably the thing that changed the most. There's different parts of different intestines in different animals. Like, you know, cows, you know, have four stomachs, right? And
right.
Cows are monogastrics, and horses are hind gut fermenters. So they have this huge long colon that comes spewing out at you when you open it up on a necropsy floor. And
fun.
And animals have a compartment. They have three stomachs called C1, C2, C3. So it's fun and infuriating to have to know all of this, especially as like a first year resident and you've forgotten all of your anatomy and you get out there and a student's like, what is that organ? And I'm like, I don't know. Let me look it up in my book. So
interesting. But in general, and just let me know how true this is. Would you say like the shapes and sizes and to some extent functions of the organs change, but there's some core similarities between most animals, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even in exotic animals, like a zebra, you don't treat a zebra like a zebra. A zebra is just a horse, you know, or even like
right. An
ostrich is just a big chicken. You know, for the most part, everything is very similar across species.
Most everybody's got legs and a GI system.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's got a liver. It works the same way. Like,
you know which one I'll bet is a little weird? You mentioned snakes a little bit. Now, everybody knows I really don't like snakes, but they probably have some pretty interesting anatomy. Can you – what are snakes like?
Well, I'll tell you that anything exotic – I almost like if we get something exotic on the floor, I'll tell the students, we're going to have fun. Why don't you go get dressed? And then I scurry back to my office and I Google snake anatomy real quick. I just need a before we go out on the floor. So pathology is a very humbling field. Like you always have to know your limits because you're never going to know it all. You just have to accept that. But yeah, snakes are fascinating. Some snakes have two lungs and some snakes have one. And all of the organs are really elongated, and the heart of the snake is about usually one third down the length of the snake. So, yeah, it's just really cool.
Is the old rumor true that like it's really hard to kill snakes because if you like cut it in half, it would still like survive? That was a rumor that I heard growing up as a kid. Like, is that true?
That is not true. The snake definitely needs the back half to survive.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that because they'd lose blood or something?
Oh, yeah. And because, I mean, you lose half your organs if you cut them in half. But I'm wondering if people told that story, like, and they just chopped off, like, the actual tail of the snake. And so then they were like, oh, this snake still survived, even though I chopped him in half, you know? So,
you know, it probably came from a movie somewhere. But, you know, hey, that's here we go. Interviews with technical people. We're going to be debunking these myths, okay? There you have it, folks. You cut a snake in half. And that's going to be the end of the snake, right? Not that we are not promoting that at all, but I just remember it was probably because I was afraid of snakes as a kid that the neighborhood kids would be like, hey, you know, like you can't kill a snake, like it's just going to keep coming after you. It was probably something like
that. I've never gotten close enough to look at the anatomy of
probably
a snake.
Wise.
It is true that a venomous snake can still kill you after death, though. If you prick yourself on its fangs, the venom will still affect.
Oh,
yeah. So you do need to be careful with
really?
That. Yeah.
That's good to know.
That's good to know. Okay.
That's why I recommend coming to Maine. We don't have any venomous snakes.
Literally.
Here. I'm packing my bag.
My dog got bit by a snake 2 days ago. I had to take her to the hospital.
Really?
Yeah. So because I'm a pathologist now, I'm not a quote unquote real vet because I can't treat my own animal. I can get drugs from our pharmacy because I'm a licensed veterinarian, but to me, her leg was so swollen. I was like, oh, her leg's broken, but I can't fix that anymore because I'm not a vet. I can't even take x-rays anymore. So I had to take her to another vet and get them to look at her for me and then give her back. It's kind of embarrassing, but I mean, that's how it goes now.
Oh my goodness. You had to take your own dog to an
to a vet. Yep. You feel a little useless, but I'm like, okay,
well,
wow. If I had something else wrong with her on the inside, I could help figure that out, maybe.
Yeah, I don't think you were useless to that person who had the zebra who was so thankful for you giving him closure. Now that you've done all this, right, and you're a real life veterinarian, do you feel like you look at animals differently now that you know so much about them?
Yeah, definitely. I have difficulty not examining them when I meet them. For example, this lady I was walking outside with my dog and she had a dog and we stopped and chatted and I looked at her dog and I was like, oh, your dog's eye. It's definitely bupthalmic. Like, does he have glaucoma? And she was like, actually, he's going to go get it removed in a week. And we just had this conversation as... It's treading a fine line of being excited about my job and knowing things and also having common courtesy and not just asking people, like, there's something wrong with your dog. You know, what if they didn't know that and I just told them that on the street? Like, that's probably not something I should do.
So of all the things you've had to learn, and now in your role as a teacher, what would you say are some difficult things about being a veterinarian that pose challenges for you or for your students?
So as a pathologist, it's definitely that our field is always growing and there's just so much more knowledge than we even had 50 years ago. But yet the time of residency is still the same. It's still 3 years and we just have so much more knowledge that we need to know. So we have to pass our boards, we have to basically memorize about 7 textbooks and we have to know about 1,500 journal articles. And it's just an overwhelming amount of information and it's only going to increase from here. And so it is very difficult to know all of it, but again, the internet's very helpful. You can just type 3 words in, and for most of the time, you'll find your diagnosis.
You have to keep reading journals to keep up on the advances.
Yeah, because there's always people finding links that we didn't know before. So if we don't know what causes something, the disease is called idiopathic. It has no cause that we know of. But commonly, people will go and research those idiopathic diseases and find out, oh, hey, this is actually a virus that we just couldn't detect before. Or, hey, this is a toxin that we didn't know about earlier. You know, things like that.
How many of the cases that you come across, you do your best to try to find what happened, why the animal died, and ultimately winds up still being mysterious, or at least not completely clear? You can't pinpoint one specific thing.
That is the pathologist's bane, is not having the answer when you're done.
Really?
And I would say, if we were to get 20 cases in a week, maybe one of them would be unsatisfactory.
Okay.
It's just it's not that common. You usually find out what's happening.
So it's usually the weird stuff. The normal stuff's pretty straightforward.
Yes. And then well, the senior pathologist, the more senior pathologists, some of them just, they can't let things go. And they're like, nope, we're going to send slides to every specialist that we know, you know, and just send it out and save tissues and look at everything. Because that's part of their love is the academic research side and learning new things too. And I'm sure I'll pick up on that once I've actually mastered more of the basics.
So. There's also the scientist idea of like, there's an answer. I know there's an answer. I have to find the answer.
Why don't you tell us about, since this is interviews with technical people, why don't you tell us about some of the technology that you employ as you do your job? Any good examples of that?
Yeah. So actually, this is really prevalent because we are in COVID time now, and so things have had to change. So normally we have rounds every week so that the residents can learn, and people bring slides and cases, and we look at them and learn about them together. But we can't gather anymore, and we can't pass around glass slides. So actually, one of the latest advances is that they're now digitizing slides. And so we have slide scanners, and then they scan them so well that we can still use a program on the computer and zoom in as if we're on a microscope, and we can zoom in and we can look at different things and we can pan around and we can measure things on our computer that we would measure on a slide. And so a lot of the private diagnostic labs around the U.S. have already been using this technology, and people are even starting to work from home because the technicians will take in the biopsies or the necropsies, do them, trim the tissues, make the slides, and then just scan the slides and send it to the pathologist. And the pathologist will read it in their pajamas at home drinking a cup of coffee. So we have been now starting to incorporate that in our learning, and it's really cool. It's a change, and I will admit I'm an old timer who's like, well, I like glass slides better, you know, but we're getting used to it, and it really is the future of our field for sure.
Really? So you think maybe, you know, even after, you know, COVID has run its course and maybe it's not absolutely required anymore, you think that'll still be a trend that'll keep going?
I think so, because one of our pathologists who is more forward thinking was trying to already kind of, like, every few months he would put out a slide set that was digital and we'd all complain about it. But now all of the slide sets are digital. And so it's just enforced a change that was coming quicker. So
I did at one point help use a digital confocal microscope. And I was just impressed at the images they were so cool. It was so much cooler than any other microscope I'd ever seen. And again, it was all savable and shareable. And it was just, microscopes are at the point where you can do that sort of stuff, and they could even set up a program so they just kind of set it up to scan on its own, where you didn't even need someone there to do some of the scanning.
Really?
Yeah, because they were like, we want to scan this area, but it's going to take a while to move around the whole thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so they could program it to just collect and save the data as it, you know, got a whole area. And with the confocal, you could see three-dimensional stuff. And so they would, you know, kind of get something and scan down through it, move and scan down through it again. And they just set those programs and leave for a few hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see you guys using stuff like that.
Yeah. So up until this point, we mostly do where we have cameras attached to our microscopes, and then the camera can feed into the computer. And that's how we sometimes, like if there's a whole room full of people, we'll just hook it up to a computer or a TV screen and use a glass slide and look around. But now we're just going to do it all digital, like you said.
How does, okay, this might be a super detailed question, but like, how does that work? Because the whole idea of a microscope is you have a magnification of a very small area, right? How can you mimic that across a whole slide in one shot?
Well,
like did we just reinvent the microscope?
Basically, they just scan at a very high magnification, and it takes a long time and it takes a lot of memory, but you're just saving a very high resolution picture down to.
Oh, so it is that. You just scan with that field of view of the microscope across the entire slide.
Yeah, right. It's not even a microscope anymore. You just like insert it into this little tiny box that's a slide
paper,
and you just put it in, and I don't know how long they take right now.
Interesting. It must still have some like microscope optics, right? There must be some like objective lens to get that magnification.
The one I've worked with, it's a microscope, but it gets a ton of images and then stitches them together into a single large zoomable image.
That's incredible technology. That's really interesting. Wow. It's funny because we have technology not too different from that in our phones. Like when we take panoramic images, as far as just like stitching together sweeps of photos. So it's neat that I didn't know that we were doing that with microscope images too.
Yeah. And we have that technology, and we had been using it where we could, like you said, manually scan a slide, but that was also very slow and very finicky, and the camera didn't always like it. And so this is basically the same process with the human error removed.
How much of the work that veterinary pathologists do leverages the work off of, say, human pathologists? Like, is it like the human pathologists usually like come up with the stuff, and then you guys, veterinary pathologists, then take it up? Or is it truly like independent, two parallel paths that are pretty different?
I would say the technology, I would say, is definitely coexisting and co-working, like whatever they're using, we're trying to use. But as far as like individual tissue identifications or stains for tissues that help us see, like, we're staining for this certain antigen, you know, like there's a specific virus that we want to stain for in here, or like human pathologists often stain for genetic mutations, and they're different between animals and humans. So that aspect, we don't overlap a whole lot. So yeah, we don't work with human pathologists very often, but I imagine the microscope people and the slide scanner technology is much more intermingled than I even realize.
Have there been any particularly interesting cases that you've encountered that you'd want to share, just things that, you know, where that you found particularly noteworthy in all of your time doing this?
One of the coolest cases I ever did was, there's you know, a sulcata tortoise is a very common type of tortoise that people own. They're usually about the size of a dinner plate, maybe. But this one was actually, I think he was a 27-year-old, 150-pound sulcata tortoise. And he was so big that I wouldn't be able to wrap my arms around him. Like, that's how big he was. And these people had him for a long time, obviously, and they loved him, and they wanted to know what was wrong. And they also wanted his shell back, which means normally how we open tortoises and turtles and tortoises is that we flip them on their back, and then you use an oscillating saw and cut through the bottom of the shell and remove that, and then just kind of look at everything inside. But his shell was like 2 to 3 inches thick in some places, and that would have taken us like years to cut through with our technology that we have on the floor. So what I ended up doing was I ended up basically diving into this tortoise with a knife and just cutting everything out of this tortoise by hand and leaving the shell intact and just pulling it all out towards me. So we have videos of me like shoulder deep in this tortoise trying to get all of its intestines and guts and everything out. And it was really cool. It was really fun. I needed
several. Wouldn't call that really cool.
That is, I wish the viewers could see my face right now. I'm just like in disbelief.
Yeah, maybe I'll have to send you.
Had to crawl inside of the tortoise.
Basically, and somebody, so the legs are also slightly attached to the shell, right? And so I was trying to disarticulate the legs from it as well. And so I had to have somebody on the outside moving the legs while I was on the inside trying to feel where the joints were so I could cut them accurately. So it was a whole show. It was great, though. It was a lot of fun.
You sound like you enjoy your work.
I do. I love what I do. The necropsy is the best part. I do love reading the slides now, the histology aspect of it, just because that's usually where the answers are. But the necropsy is what made me fall in love with it. And just, I don't know, everybody gets grossed out by it. But once you do it a couple of times yourself, just cutting animals open, it's so satisfying to just find answers right there in front of your face.
Does it make you sad too, or is it just more of the excitement of exploration of these animals?
It's not sad as people think, because you don't see the animals when they were alive. The sad part of being a veterinarian is definitely the euthanasia and like knowing the patients for a long time and then having to put them down. But by the time they get to us, we don't know them, we're not connected with them. And so for us, it's just the excitement of like a treasure hunt, basically. So which we try to quell that excitement so people don't get disgusted with us.
Right. That's fair.
So do you have to deliver the results to people? Like, for example, there's a dog. Are you the one who has to go like deliver the results, say, to the owner?
No.
And say what happened?
Mm-mm. So we write up the report in, you know, as objective of a style as we can. And we give a little synopsis at the end saying, hey, these are all the things that we found that we think are related to his condition. maybe here's a few other things that we found that are important, but probably didn't kill him. And then the clinicians get to see that. They get to see the pictures, and then they share whatever they want with the client at will. Some clients want to see pictures, especially if they're like vet students. Most of them don't. So
you don't have to deal with the psychology of pet ownership on your business end.
And that was one of the reasons I didn't want to be a general practitioner. Honestly, I just, okay. Because everybody wants to be a vet because they love animals, right? But vetting is actually 10% animals, 90% people. And if you don't like people, you're going to have a really hard time doing this job.
But you're great with people.
Yeah, maybe I missed out, but it's too much fun now. Can't go back.
So from the time we knew you, or when we met you, say, and as you were going through this whole process, are there any parts of like learning to become a veterinarian that were different from what you expected? And I think this would be useful for anyone who thinks about being a veterinarian and maybe like romanticizes it, and then the reality is probably different from how it seems, right? Mm-hmm. Did you find any cases like that?
Yeah, as James said, I definitely didn't expect the psychological aspect so much. A lot of people who want to go to vet school do start in shadowing, and so you get to see an aspect of that, but it's so different than experiencing a pet owner who's sobbing in front of you or sobbing into your shoulder, and especially when you're a student and you don't even have control over the case, you're just the one who has to deliver the news, per se. And so we actually had a class that was strictly dealing with how do you deal with owners and how do you de-escalate a situation if the client's getting angry, and how do you emotionally comfort somebody who's sad, and how do you work with people who are trying to manipulate you. So that was, I knew that going in, but it was just a lot more intense. And they also don't tell you that I think a lot of vets come out very ill-prepared to run a business, which is what you should be able to do one day if you want to be a vet and make a lot of money. But all of us are just like, hey, biology, animals, great. And then we're like, oh, wait, we know nothing about salaries and commissions and anything. So,
interesting. Huh. The business aspect of being a vet.
Yeah,
yeah, a lot of them are small town. I say the ones that I know are all small town, you know, practitioners, and it's a small business you get to run. And
I think this would be a good time to ask, one of the questions that we always like to ask Carmen is, in your field specifically, or even beyond your field, like what gets you excited about the future, as far as things that are up and coming, changes that are happening? And then we also like to ask what gets you concerned about the future. But why don't we start with excited?
Exciting about the future? I think our future is always exciting because we're just genuinely continuously discovering. As far as technological advances, I think the slides becoming digitized are about as much as we can have. And they're starting to make databases of digital slides. So people are saying like, this is a strictly skin database. So you can look at all the dermatological problems that are common, like pemphigus and allergies and like a burn, and people will put them into the databases and have different parts of it labeled. They're like, this is what you absolutely need for your diagnosis, and this is what you can see sometimes. So I think that's really cool, and I'm really excited to have all sorts, and most, for the most part, a lot of these databases are often free because we're just trying to help each other, right? Everybody wants everybody else to get the right diagnosis. And so I think that's really exciting, that people are just sharing so much of this knowledge the more technology advances.
Okay, I have a question. So my wife is a surgeon, and she spends like so much time like on YouTube watching videos of surgeries, and it's so funny because I'll just like look over and be like, what you watching? I'm like, ah! Some kind of like that stuff's all on YouTube. And you know, to my eyes, it seems like it's like you were saying where, you know, you've seen it so many times that it's just like, you know, it's satisfactory. But like, I know when I watch videos of surgeries, like my first response is like, oh, that's like horrific. But of course it's not, right? It's just the human body, right?
Yeah.
Do you spend time watching videos of like procedures and things like that? You know, is that part of what you do?
We actually have a Facebook page where people get to post their cool cases. And so they'll post either pictures, we call them gross pictures of the actual bodies and the actual organs. And sometimes they'll post histology pictures with them, and we all geek out over them for sure. We're like, oh, that's so cool. Or, you know, we just get really excited about those kinds of things. Not so much videos, but definitely, definitely pictures, a lot of pictures.
Okay, and I also now learned that gross has two meanings. So when you say there's a gross picture, it mean I think it just means like a large view.
Yes. So think of gross as the macroscopic. Yes.
Okay. So if you're saying gross, you mean macroscopic. When I'm when I look at that picture and say it's a gross picture, it probably means it's, you know, grotesque.
Well, right. It helps you remember, because if it's a gross picture, it's something you can stick your hands in and it's gross. So it's the same thing.
I don't know if we talked about what you're concerned about with the future, too, for the second half of that question you'd asked, John.
Mm-hmm. My definite immediate concern is that a lot of vet schools, they're always looking for ways to... Well, everybody thinks their own profession is the most important, right? And so ER says that students aren't spending enough time on ER, or people aren't spending enough time on internal medicine, or students want more of the dermatology or something. And so frequently when that happens, often pathology is the first one to get cut out of the program. People are saying, maybe we don't need 2 weeks of pathology. Maybe you only need 1 week of pathology as a fourth year, because we're not treating things. It's only looking at them after death. And a lot of vets don't even do necropsies on their patients that have died. Is it a super vital skill for being a veterinarian? No, in one sense of the clinical aspect. But I would argue yes, because it helps you put together, like, okay, this is what a liver looks like if you have metastatic cancer. So if you know what that liver looks like, then when you see that on ultrasound, when you see that on radiographs, when you see that on any sort of imaging modality, then you can say, oh, okay, that to me looks like it could be metastatic cancer, and you immediately have a better picture in your mind of what you were looking for. So I think pathology is much more essential to keeping a rounded perspective of what organs look like, both normal and abnormal. But often schools are trying to cut their necropsy programs because students feel as it's not as important. And some vet students actually get grossed out by what we do. And I'm like, well, this is kind of part of your path, so you have to get used to it.
Another thing I had, which is, and this is not very technical, but I feel like asking anyway. One of my least favorite things I've ever come across is formaldehyde. Yeah. I feel like that's something you probably have to work with pretty commonly. And how do you deal with that?
So we actually have,
what's your view on it?
We have like biosafety cabinets, sort of, but we just have really well ventilated rooms. So actually, when you open a jar of formaldehyde, when you're in this well ventilated room right next to the hood, you can't smell it hardly at all. If you don't have the hood on,
That's good.
Yeah, if it's broken, which it has happened several times, like you can't hardly breathe while you're standing there working. But so it doesn't affect me too much. But some of the older pathologists that I first started working with have that kind of smoker's cough, rattly sounds in their chest, I think, from years of working with formaldehyde, which is terrifying.
Yeah, James, you just gave me flashbacks to like biology class dissecting the fetal pigs. Oh, my goodness.
I worked in a physics lab that shared the lab with some biologists, and I would have to walk by the formaldehyde to get to my station. And I was like, this is terrible. I hate this.
It's not something you get used to. You just have, you're better equipped to deal with it. The smell of the necropsy itself, that you have to get used to. We have a lot of students that our secret is, you like Jodie Foster in Silence of the Lambs, like they put like the Vicks VapoRub under their lips so you can't smell anything that's coming up.
So you can smell is Vicks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't bother me. Like, there's hardly anything that could make me gag, but some of the students are very sensitive. So. Okay.
So another thing that I've heard, so I know a lot of surgeons just because I'm like in that community, is they've actually said, like, I've asked that question to them, like, when you're in surgery and you're cutting, in this case, a person open, I would ask them, does it smell? And they would actually say no. Like, in general, like, the human body is very sterile, like, unless it's like you're, like the intestines, I guess, that ruptured or like an abscess. Is that generally true for the animals? But they've died, right? So there could be all sorts of decay and everything. This is like going off on a whole tangent now, but I'm just curious.
No, I mean, this is what we deal with every day.
Right. This is your job.
And how quick do you get these animals after they die, and how much have they decayed by then?
So that's a great question. So we do necropsies every day. So hopefully it's within the 24-hour frame. And before that, if there's an animal that's died, they put them in this large cooler that we have right next to the necropsy room. So we just bring them out of the cooler. And the large animals we have to bring out on a hoist because they're, you know, 1,000 pounds or so. Right. But a small animal, like a dog, is going to chill down in the cooler very quickly. And it's going, all the processes of the proteins and the enzymes are going to stop. So it's going to cool down and not undergo autolysis, as we call it, which is just basically decay. But a large animal, like a cow, has an abdomen so big that you could fit inside of it. And obviously, if it's sitting in a cooler just for a few hours, the inside are still going to be just as warm as when it died. So they rot a lot faster. So a dog that's been sitting...
That's thermodynamic.
So a dog that's been sitting in the cooler for a day, I'm like, oh, this isn't too bad. A cow that's been sitting in a cooler for a day, I'm like, And sometimes the clients don't always submit them right away because they're like, oh, I don't know if I want to pay for a necropsy. I don't know if we need it. And then, so we'll just hold the carcass. But then maybe we've had one up to like 5 days later, they decided they wanted the necropsy. And that was really gross. I did not appreciate that. Yeah.
What is the largest animal you've ever performed a necropsy on?
Thanks for asking. It's one of my favorite stories. So just for perspective, your average horse is about 800, 900 pounds, right? Your typical, not huge, not small, just your average horse, about 800, 900 pounds. This was a 2,000-pound bull. It's called a Beefmaster bull. And he died.
Like a bull with horns?
Or? Yeah. He was... I think he was 11 and he got osteoarthritis in his hips because he was just so large. He got osteoarthritis in his hips and he couldn't be used for breeding anymore. So they brought him in. And that was a challenge. Let me tell you that, because we take, like, think of your biggest gardening shears. That's what we usually cut ribs with. And it's already really hard. But then on a rib, that's like, you know, 3 by 2 inches around, like that's really difficult for a very small person like me. So that bull.
And he must have been pretty muscular too.
Yeah. So you have to cut away all the muscle to expose the ribs, and then you got to cut down all the ribs, and they have, you know, more ribs than we do. And so it's a long process. And his head was so big that normally we set the animal heads in a vise and we clamp them down in the vise, and then we can cut open the skull to get at the brain, right? But his head was so big, it was like the size of a footrest, and we couldn't put it in the vise. So I just had to do it on the floor, and that was the first day I ever learned how to take a brain out with a hatchet. And that was really cool. That was a really exciting day for me.
Wow.
This podcast just went off the wall. Oh my goodness. You put the bull head in a vise?
I love that you guys use high-tech equipment like hatchets, too.
I know. I'm actually really good with a hatchet now, too.
Oh my goodness! You're just swinging away at, at this bull.
Yep. It was a huge head. I'll have to send you guys pictures. I bet you guys will really like them. If you don't get grossed out, I guess.
Okay. Send them over. But
I don't know. We'll see. I don't know yet.
No, gotta send them. Send the photos. We won't post them on the show notes. We'll just look at them and we'll post our reaction. Wow.
Yes. That was a very
fun. Okay, well, I have an inverse question then. What is the smallest animal you've ever done a necropsy on?
The smallest.
We're covering every base here.
The smallest animal I've ever done a necropsy on. I don't know how successful the necropsy was, because I couldn't even barely see anything. It was a tadpole, and it was about 1 centimeter in diameter, and he was basically so gelatinous and clear that I could see right through him anyway, but I was like, well, I may as well open him up and see if I can see anything. So in those cases, when we have such small animals or fish, you often just cut them lengthwise down the middle, and then you just put them to, like, the whole animal in as a slide, and you'll read the whole body of the animal as one slide.
That's, like, more sophisticated than I would have thought for a tadpole. That's interesting. Yeah. You could put the entire thing, and I'm like, oh, you know what's interesting about that? There's some, you know, there's certain, like, confocal microscopes where you can do sort of like different depth penetrations optically. I'm just thinking, like, if you have a tadpole that's already semi-transparent, you could actually potentially go just optically that microscope and look at different levels, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You could have he didn't get an opportunity for that.
Yeah, but, we have dissecting microscopes. We don't commonly use them because nobody usually submits tadpoles. That was when I was at an aquarium my fourth year. But yeah, you could theoretically.
I would love to understand what this like great like tadpole mystery is. Like everyone's like, what happened to him? We need to solve the mystery.
Sorry, that one's one of the, you know, one of the 20 that's just gonna go unknown.
Unknown.
Interesting. Yeah, when I it's funny because when I asked like what was the smallest animal, I was like 70% sure it would be a fish. So I was close.
You were very close. And I have done several fish. But the tadpole, I distinctly remember. And I remember the aquarist that I was working with. She's like, why do you want to do a necropsy on it? I was like, I want to see if I can. The answer is not really.
I say a fish meat seems fairly simple. I feel like you just like start filleting it like, you know, after you catch a trout.
I mean, pretty much. I think you just fillet it, try not to.
Like salmon?
And you look at it.
Yeah, I guess they do cut fish into steaks at the grocery store, you know, like cross sections and everything. Yeah, you can learn a lot just from that.
Well, and that's what people are asking. They're like, can you butcher an animal? And I'm like, oh, butchery is like an art that I don't know how to do, but I would love to learn. Because sometimes you get those big, huge cows out on the necropsy floor, and maybe they were just like hit by lightning or they broke a leg. So they don't have drugs in them. And I'm like, look at all this steak that's going to waste. Like, can I just take some of this home? That's very much brown.
There must be some rule against that. There has to be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's definitely not allowed, but it would be nice.
I feel like the difference is you're looking for a diseased tissue, not like the filet mignon, you know, the top sirloin.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know where those things are, but I see a lot of meat. And sometimes on the days when you're hungry, you're like, that looks pretty good.
But I know here in Maine, if a deer gets hit by a car and it's still in good condition, you can butcher it up and give it to the shelter. So it's still died, but still usable meat.
Huh. So you've been looking for
a
deer?
Did you do that in your lab?
Yeah, but you probably forfeit that if you send it out for a necropsy, though. Then it's out of your hands.
If you don't put drugs in, and if it's still fresh, I mean, couldn't you save some of it? I don't know.
I think it was the same thing in New York. You can keep your deer that you hit with your car. You know, assuming it was an accident.
I think we can help no, update nobody. The world of purpose. Yeah, we can update the world of pathology and let them keep the meat. You know,
That's progressive. Less weight.
Yeah. That's what happened when physicists get a hold of pathology.
They're like, can we eat it or can we not eat it? Just tell me.
Right.
James, I'm so I want to ask you any more questions because this makes me want to talk about nothing less than food.
I know, this is a great segue.
But if you have any other questions, let me know. Carmen, there's one question that we ask every single person who comes on the show, and you're no exception, regardless of the topics that we discuss. What is your favorite pizza topping?
I think mine is actually caramelized onions. I don't think there's a pizza out there that could not be improved by caramelized onions. Just in love with them.
Caramelized onions, like roast onions, like flame caramelized.
Yeah, or like pan seared onions, like because they're already like sweet and juicy, and they're not tart.
Oh,
yeah, and they just
like fajitas.
Yeah, like fajitas, and I feel like they just add so much depth to like any pizza. Like you can add them to like a margarita pizza or like a meat lover's pizza, and it doesn't matter. It's gonna taste good on all of them. So,
do you add them on before or after you bake the pizza?
Before. Because I feel like onion, like if you have a pizza with onions baked into it, the onions are not always cooked when they come out. You know, sometimes they're still a little crunchy and you're like, I didn't really want raw onion on my pizza.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
That's how I get most of mine, is they're like half cooked, still crunchy.
Yeah, and nobody likes that, but if they're already cooked and then basically you're just heating them up, like, I think they're delicious.
Okay. Here's the thing, Carmen. I'm a pizza purist.
Uh-oh.
And I truly think the best pizza topping is like no topping, right? Just cheese and sauce.
What?
But yeah, it's true. That's pizza. But like what you said about the onions, the funny thing is that's kind of true of a lot of food. Like if you just take anything and add onions, it adds a flavor to it. It adds moisture. Ah, interesting.
Yep. Yeah, we almost always add onions to any vegetable we have in the house.
It's like garlic.
When you have a stir fry.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
start with the onion.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's so funny. When we always ask everyone what their pizza topping is, I want to, like, find a reason to think that that pizza topping is, like, no good, but then I never can. I'm like, you're right. That's a great topping.
Well, if you have somebody that's...
I can't argue with that.
Let me know if you can get your way around that.
Absolutely. Wow. Time flies. Carmen, are there any last things you might want to talk about that you think would be interesting to share?
Just that I think everybody should go and try and see a necropsy at least once, because it is an experience and it is pretty cool.
In person, right? So like YouTube does not substitute. You have to go.
You have to see go a in necrop- person, because you also have to catch the enthusiasm of the people that are doing it. Like we all, like you can't be in pathology and not love it. We love what we do and everybody gets really excited and we scream at each other across the floor like, come see this, you know? And you just have to catch that feeling and then the excitement of learning and discovering, like it's so exhilarating. Adrenaline rushes.
But what about with a guy like me? And in high school bio, we had to dissect a worm and a fish and I was able to not touch any of that. I succeeded. That. And so like you've got people like me to deal with too.
Yeah, but we have an observation deck on our necropsy floor, and so people can come, like clinicians okay. can come and watch without getting their hands dirty. So I think
I might be able to work with that.
Exactly.
So if we showed up to your hospital, would we be able to view it in that booth, the observation deck?
I used to bring people in all the time before COVID. I was like, come on, just stand there and watch for five minutes or an hour and just see what I do. And, you know, you get a lot of varying responses. Some people are really excited. My mom loved it when I brought her. She was just so thrilled and she like wanted to poke me. And I was like, well, you're up there, you know, and my dad, I could tell in the first 5 minutes, he was like, okay, this is cool. I think I'm done.
Okay, one last question. When you are doing your thing, doing your necropsy, is music playing in the room?
Oh, yes. It is a requirement, and I usually get to be the DJ, but sometimes I let my students pick. But it's never country. We cannot have any country. No way. But
it's Texas, Carmen.
And I'm not a Texan, so no, we listen to a lot of pop music, and I prefer, because when the students are working and I don't have anything to do, I hate being bored. So we have to have music so that I can dance just around.
So it's a nice, relaxed environment where everybody's just having a good time.
Oh, yeah. People love the necropsy rotation after the first few days. Once they get over the grossness of it, they're like, you guys really have a good time. And I'm like, oh, please. We throw a party every day.
You need to be the spokeswoman for veterinary pathology, like nationally. Like you can convince people to join the field. You're going to get a surge of applications now.
I'm going to sell it as hard as I can.
Yeah. Wow, this is awesome. Well, I don't think I have any more questions. James, you got anything?
No, I that's all I got for right now.
Well, you guys asked great questions, so thanks for having me here today.
I love the episodes where we have like follow-up actions. So now we need to go see one of these. Mm-hmm. And if possible, we'll go see you performing.
Everybody come to College Station. We will see a necropsy together.
we'll record an episode. Awesome. All right. Well, yeah. If that's all we have, thank you so much, Carmen. This was great.
Yeah, yes. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.